I'm Jason Van Medding.
And I'm Ksenia Chmutina.
Welcome to Disasters Deconstructed podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Disaster Deconstructed. Well, I think it's been quite an exciting journey so far. So we've talked a lot about language. We've, I think, unpacked quite in detail the whole use and idea behind the natural disasters misnomer. We've talked about status quo. And well, there's so much more we can talk about. And hopefully today will be one of those episodes where we will discuss all these issues a little bit more.
Yeah, really excited about this episode. And it makes me think back to when we talked to Tony Oliver Smith about root causes for a couple episodes. And he was speaking to some of the research he'd done previously in Haiti and elsewhere on looking at the historical context of risk creation. And in the Haiti example in particular, talking about the legacy of colonialism, and just looking at how culture had been shaped as a result of control and exploitation of people in Haiti and their land. So today we're going to dig into that a bit more, and we're going to talk about post-colonialism and neocolonialism, and indeed the link to our economic system that's become dominant, neoliberalism. So lots of jargon in there, Ksenia, right?
So much jargon, our jargon jar, whatever it's called. It'll be full today.
Yeah.
Well, and the contributor to our jargon jar today is Gonzalo Lizaralde. Hi, Gonzalo.
Hello.
It's so nice to have you on the podcast today. I mean, well, Gonzalo and Jason and I, we're all friends, you know, so it's an absolute pleasure talking to you as always. And I kind of miss you being in Loughborough, you know. It was nice having you here for half a year, because nobody since have brought me croissants at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, so please come back.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to this podcast. I have enjoyed very much the previous episodes, and I look forward to hearing the next ones.
Thank you. Well, so let me just say a couple of words about you, and then, of course, you can add. So if you remember, you know, to the audience, in the beginning of the podcast, we had a special episode from Iraq, and also we actually referred to Iraq conference quite a few times on the season. So Gonzalo is one of the founding members of Iraq, so an international network for improving post-disaster reconstruction. And so we really appreciate your efforts in that space, Gonzalo. And Gonzalo is based in Montreal, doing quite interesting work. So you are based in the Department of Architecture and Built Environment, isn't it? Or School of Architecture and Built Environment.
That's right, the School of Architecture.
Yeah, yet quite a lot of your work isn't, you know, about creating models, really, but more talking about capitalism and neoliberalism and disaster capitalism and reconstruction and all these difficult things that we're really trying to unpack. Can you actually explain to us what do all these isms mean? You know, so what's neoliberalism? What neocolonialism? What's capitalism in your context, in your interpretation?
Sure. And again, thank you very much for this invitation. Colonialism, neocolonialism, and neoliberalism are certainly not the same, but they share a tendency to impose military, political, and economic power, often on the global south, basically on developing countries, on poor countries. In all of these cases, there are economic and political conditions that are imposed on governments and local institutions, and usually those are imposed by more powerful nations. Those who do not comply to those conditions usually face economic isolation. Think, for example, of Cuba. The Cuban embargo imposed by the United States is a good example of how those governments or institutions that do not comply to the principles decided by the North are then penalized. But they also face sometimes military intervention. So when governments or local institutions refuse to follow the conditions that are imposed by more powerful nations, they often face military intervention. And the history of Latin America is also full of examples in which, for example, the United States, sometimes supported also by European countries, imposed a series of conditions in Latin American countries and the Caribbean in order to pursue certain political agendas. Those governments and countries that did not comply to those requirements were then imposed economic restrictions, economic isolation, and in some cases, military intervention. In most of the cases also, this pressure comes with removal of governments, simply removing leading politicians in the South and replacing them with others that are more sympathetic to the conditions that are trying to be imposed in these countries, often after conditions imposed by powerful nations such as the United States or colonial European governments. So this is, of course, these are different contexts. When we talk about colonialism, we're talking about a direct rule, whereas in neocolonialism and neoliberalism, we're not necessarily talking about direct rule by countries on the North in countries on the South, but there is kind of a certain imposition of rules. And this is where the three forms of domination become closer.
Wow, yeah, this is very complicated, but so relevant to disaster studies, isn't it?
And maybe the best way to start unpacking this is through examples. So let me give you one example that might help us a little bit with this. We could talk, for example, about the imposition of Reaganomics and Thatcherism in Latin America and the Caribbean. And I'm sorry, because here there are two more terms. The Reaganomics refer, of course, to the neoliberal policies that were drafted during the Ronald Reagan presidency in the United States, and Thatcherism is the equivalent of that in the UK during the administration of Margaret Thatcher. But what we're talking about here is about setting up rules of economic structures and political structures that were defined in Washington or London, and that were later imposed in Latin American countries. And this basically happened in the 1980s and the 1990s. Neoliberal policies that were drafted in Washington and were drafted in London were later imposed in, for example, Central American countries, such as El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and many others. This is what many scholars have called the Washington Consensus. So let me explain a little bit of what this Washington Consensus was about. It was about setting up a series of conditions and regulations and impose them in developing countries in order to receive support by richer nations. They usually implied that local governments should reduce the size of the state. So there was kind of a consensus that the state should be kept to the minimum. There was also the idea that governments should reduce investment in social programs, that a series of social support and social programs should be transferred to the private sector, and supposedly because this private sector was going to be able to provide those services in a more efficient manner. Another aspect was the privatization of services and infrastructure. So privatizing utilities, privatizing companies that provided infrastructure and services was a key component of neoliberal policy imposed in the South. Another aspect was selling state's assets. Part of the idea of reducing the size of the state was to reduce also public institutions and agencies. And that implies selling, for example, public utilities to the private sector, making them basically private companies. Another aspect was reducing taxes. The idea was that by imposing less taxes on citizens, then the markets would work in a better way. And finally, another important component was to eliminate tariffs so that poor countries would import more from developed countries, hopefully will export also more. But basically, the general idea was that by reducing commerce tariffs, then kind of a global integration in global markets would be possible. And this is basically what was imposed in a series of countries in Latin America and the Caribbean in the 1980s and the 1990s.
Well, I guess this links nicely to the arguments that, you know, they have been recently appearing, particularly in international relations and development studies, in that today's neoliberalism and today's neoliberal urbanization is actually closely linked to yesterday's urbanization of empire. What do you think?
Yes, and if I may also, let's make a connection now to disasters and to risk. We have heard since the last 6 months about this caravan of Latin Americans walking towards the frontier with the United States. You have probably heard about thousands of Latin Americans coming from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, that have been walking all these miles to reach the border with the United States. And as we know today, this has caused a major crisis, a refugee crisis in the southern border of the United States. When this caravan approached the United States, many journalists and observers noticed that these Latin Americans were escaping poverty and violence. And that is certainly true. They were escaping the violence and the poverty that has characterized these countries for many years. But very few observers actually link this to a kind of more longer history of political and economic conditions. And this is where the whole thing becomes interesting. And let me tell you an example of what I witnessed in Central America. In 2004, 2003, I conducted research in El Salvador and Honduras. In one of my visits, for example, I went to the planning office of the capital of El Salvador, called San Salvador. I visited the planning office and I found one employee. There was one person in charge of planning the city, the capital city of El Salvador. He was alone. He didn't have any staff. He was sitting in a small office and he was in charge of making all the important decisions about the city. This was, to be clear, this was a very intelligent man. This was a very intelligent and skillful person, but he was alone doing a tremendous and demanding task. Why this happened? Because El Salvador during the 1980s and the 1990s suffered from these neoliberal policies that were imposed by the United States. So by shrinking the state and by privatizing services, basically, El Salvador led to the conditions in which finally there were no institutions to deal with housing and infrastructure. So what happened later? Earthquakes hit El Salvador. And when those earthquakes happened, if I remember properly, that was in 1998 or 1999, when two earthquakes hit the capital of El Salvador, San Salvador. What happened at that moment was that there was no institutions to face the disaster. There were basically no staff, there was no institutions, there were no mechanisms, there was no support to deal with the housing crisis, there was no institutions capable of dealing with new infrastructure that was required, there were no institutions with the capacity to respond to the damages that were caused by these disasters. And why that happened? Well, that happened because after the Washington Consensus, the state was basically depleted and reduced to its minimum form. So what happened later was that there was no reconstruction. When I visited in 2004 El Salvador, I wanted to know what had been done to rebuild. And the person working in the planning office, I told you about this lonely officer working there, told me something very important. He told me, I'm going to tell you the story of the reconstruction that never happened. There was no reconstruction in San Salvador. There was no reconstruction because there was nobody there to conduct the housing and infrastructure recovery that was required. Why did it happen? This happened because of neoliberal policies that were imposed in the country 2 decades before. And now, when we see these migrants walking towards the United States, we should not forget that these people are escaping poverty. True. They're also escaping violence. True. But they're also escaping the conditions that were accumulated for 20 years after imposing neoliberal policies in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. When I visited Honduras, I visited the city of Choluteca. I found exactly the same situation I just presented about El Salvador. Unfortunately, the disaster was different. In this case, was the destruction caused by Hurricane Mitch. But basically, the same result appeared in Honduras. There was nobody there from the state, from public institutions, to deal with the damage that was caused by Hurricane Mitch. There was a very weak reconstruction process following Hurricane Mitch, and all of this eventually led to additional poverty, isolation, marginalization, lack of services, and all of this fueled the violence and the poverty that now Latin Americans are trying to escape when they walk towards the American border.
Something that's really missing from the discussion in the US right now with regards to the so-called caravan is just the role of US foreign policy in shaping those conditions that people flee. And in particular, in relation to Honduras, you think back to the 2009 military coup and the role that the US could have played in maintaining the democratic government there, but decided that for whatever strategic interests, it would not do so and implicitly support the coup. So, and we're talking about the administration of Obama with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, inspired by Henry Kissinger, and that sort of position to the rest of the world of maintaining US strategic interests. So I think it's definitely a touchy subject here and not something that most of the media will dig into.
Absolutely. To be sure, these are connections that are very difficult to make, but we have to make an effort to clarify them and to talk about them. Naomi Klein is well known for making those connections between violence and neoliberal policies. And she's right. She's right. The history of Latin America, for example, is full of these connections. But we should also not forget that there are other components that sometimes are not fully represented in Naomi Klein's narrative. For example, the bad guys are not only found on the north. Corrupted politicians in the south have also played an important role in colonialism and the imposition of neoliberal policies in the south. There has been a complicit collaboration between economic and political elites in the North and the South to impose colonial rule and new forms of domination. There have been alliances between local politicians and economic powers, for example. There have been personal vendettas between local politicians. There has been racism, segregation, and neglect also within countries on the South. Local elites, for example, discriminate against others in their own cities and countries. So we certainly need to make an effort to make these connections. Because what we're facing today is a refugee crisis. What we're facing today is an environmental crisis. And what we're facing today is an increase in the intensity and frequency of disasters. And these three things are deeply interconnected. And we have to understand them through the connections we can make about them.
Yeah, I want to ask you some more about that in the context of Haiti in particular. So, Ksenia, I've been noticing that you've posted quite a lot about Haiti in the past while on social media, talking about neoliberalism and disaster risk creation. On Twitter, you wrote, and I'll quote you, "Neoliberal policy in Haiti is a great example of disaster creation. In 2009, Clinton apologized about it. We made this devil's bargain. A terrible reconstruction plan followed." And maybe you can tell us a bit more about what you meant by this and just reflect on some of those risk creation dynamics in Haiti in particular, where you have worked.
Yes. I've been working in Haiti since 2010 when the earthquake happened. And what we have witnessed, me and my team, what we've witnessed in Haiti is very similar to what we also saw in El Salvador and Honduras. Basically, how a country that is hit by a major disaster is not able to recover later. Why? Because there are no strong institutions to deal with that. Because there are no mechanisms. Because there are no strong governance structures to deal with that. And this is the result of, again, neoliberal policies that were imposed, in this case in Haiti, in the 1980s, 1990s, and 2000. The same formula was applied, you know, reduction of tariffs, reducing taxes, selling the state's assets, privatization of services and infrastructure, reduction of the investment, public investment in social programs, and reduction of the state. The same formula was applied for many years in Haiti, including military intervention, removing governments, and imposing this type of economic policy. Haiti went from being a largely autonomous country in food production to become, in the 2000s, a country that is dependent on imports. Take the example of rice. Haiti before could be able to produce enough rice and food to feed its country. It doesn't happen anymore. Haiti today is one of the principal importers of food from the United States in the Caribbean. It's one of the largest importers of rice coming from the United States. And yes, Bill Clinton, who acted in post-disaster Haiti very actively and who tried to do a series of reconstruction programs in Haiti, was partly involved in applying this neoliberal policy when he was president of the United States. I recently found, for a book I'm writing now, I recently found a very rare video in which Clinton apologizes before a U.S. Senate committee for the economic and political mistakes he made in Haiti. After the disaster, he tried to catch up, and the Clinton Foundation did a series of efforts to develop what they called the Building Back Better program, an attempt to rebuild Haiti. But again, the attempt was based on the same common tricks, you know, delegating reconstruction to private companies, involving international companies in reconstruction, transferring contracts to scholars and companies in the United States, trying to master plan the recovery of Port-au-Prince, the capital city of Haiti, and things like that. Eventually, the Building Back Better program of the Clinton Foundation failed. It achieved very little, almost nothing. Most of the promise of aid that was offered after the disaster, actually this aid and this money never actually reached Port-au-Prince. It certainly didn't reach Haiti at all. And what we know at the end is that a very weak reconstruction program followed. And part of the reason is that the Haitian state was not capable of dealing with this important disaster. There have been improvements. The government today is stronger than it was in 2010. There have been new public institutions that have been created. UCLBP, for its acronym in English, is now a strong institution in Haiti. It's a public institution that was created after the disaster and is conducting some efforts for rebuilding. So there have been improvements, certainly, but the main conclusion here is that policies that were imposed in the country for many years before the disaster eventually led to the destruction that happened and eventually led to a very weak reconstruction process.
Of course, as you know, neoliberal bureaucrats love to point to these things as justification of, you guessed it, more neoliberal interventions. So how do we break out of this cycle of results of neoliberalism being used to justify more neoliberalism?
Right. When we see more successful cases of reconstruction, there is something that always appears as a common pattern. Take, for example, the Gujarat reconstruction after, what was it, 2001, the earthquake in Gujarat, India? Take also the example of the Colombian reconstruction project that followed the 1999 earthquake. In these cases, there was something in common. Strong public institutions committed to protect citizens and protect the environment. These were not reconstruction processes in which the responsibility was delegated to the market. These were not reconstruction processes in which private companies were called up to assume the role that the government usually assumes. These were reconstruction processes in which public institutions were consolidated. Some new institutions were created, like the Gujarat Reconstruction Authority, for example. And those public institutions took the responsibility of the reconstruction. They took responsibility for housing development. They assume responsibility for infrastructure recovery and new infrastructure construction. They took responsibility for protecting citizens. They took responsibilities for protecting the environment. And yes, in these cases, there was an involvement of the private sector. There were certainly companies involved. There was certainly civil society organizations that were involved. But there was a leader. And those leaders were public institutions that were able to deal with the overwhelming demands of caused by the disaster. So there is a lesson here to be learned, is that we, in order to create the conditions, for example, for housing development, we need to have strategies, mechanisms, policies, and funding. And that's basically a strong institution. And those strong institutions are usually weakened by neoliberal policy. So we need to avoid weakening those institutions, because when we need them, they need to be strong to deal with the overwhelming needs of the disasters impose. So it is important that we take care of these organizations, that we take care of these institutions, that they build knowledge, that they build, that they were properly staffed, that they are properly funded, that knowledge is accumulated. So when there is a need for housing, when there is a need for infrastructure, when there is a need for social programs, they have the capacity to deal with these challenges.
But I guess this goes against the idea of capitalism, isn't it? And it was Marx who said that we, in capitalism, the resources are being taken but never returned, really. And I guess we see this unfolding over and over again.
Yes, that's the importance of creating a new narrative, of creating a new narrative about risk, of creating a new narrative about disasters. We cannot keep replicating the narrative of savage capitalism. We cannot keep replicating the narrative of neoliberalism. We need to create a new narrative, understanding risk and disasters in a different way. And and changing the language and the podcasts that you have been doing about thinking about the language are very important in creating these new narratives. We have to start thinking differently. For example, start thinking differently about the informal sector. Usually when disaster happens, the informal sector is blamed for the destruction. This certainly happened in Haiti. After the 1999 earthquake in Haiti, most observers, both local and international, blame informal construction companies for the disaster. Many jumped to the conclusion that the houses had been destroyed because they were built through poor construction methods due to the lack of capacities that the informal sector have. But this narrative is missing something important. It was actually this informal sector, the only industry capable of providing an affordable solution to those poor people. So we need to complement this explanation. We need to complete this explanation with something else. And it's the important role that informal businesses and informal settlements play in creating contemporary cities. So instead of blaming this informal sector for the destruction that is caused after disasters, we probably need to understand the role they play in solving the very solutions that the poor often found, and the only solutions actually that the poor often found. And this means that a new narrative is necessary, a narrative in which this informal sector, for example, is recognized for its contribution, it's integrated in housing solutions and strategies and funding, it's integrated in infrastructure development, in which civil society groups at the grassroots level are also integrated in decision-making, in which vulnerable citizens are giving decision-making power, and in which we replace the idea of a small state and transfer of responsibilities to the private sector. We replace it with the idea of strong institutions that are able to integrate this private sector with the type of policies and regulations that are required today to protect citizens and nature.
Well, I will come back to informal because that is a very interesting story. That's an interesting narrative. But another narrative I'd like to ask you about is that idea of normal and, you know, going back to normal and going back, building back to normal, which we very often hear in Reconstruction, right? So we try to sort of build back better. We try to return to normal. And in his book, Franz Fanon in 1961, he said that basically the colonial cities, they consist of two parts. And the one city is bright and brightly lit and strongly built. And the part where colonized people live is a hungry town stuffed of bread, of meat, of shoes, of coal, and of light. And we see that very often after a disaster, right? When a place is reconstructed and what is brightly lit is very often those places that the tourists would come back for or to, the holiday destinations or the financial sectors, and the places where normal people live, they're not lit at all. So how do we fight that normal that isn't actually normal at all?
Sure. Of course, economic recovery is important after disasters. Of course it is. It is necessary that business go back to production. It's necessary that an economic recovery emerges very soon. But it is also important to remember that those benefits are not necessarily shared by all. Quite often, when capitalism kicks in and disaster capitalism kicks in, the benefits are concentrated on only a few corporations and companies. What we need to do is to create the conditions for local economic recovery at the grassroots level. And this is what happens in more successful cases of reconstruction. Again, the reconstruction process in rural Colombia in 1999 is a good example, or the Gujarat reconstruction is also a good example, in which there was an economic recovery because there was an economic recovery bottom up, and not only because of the arrival of new corporations. Of course, this is difficult to implement. We saw, for example, after the tsunami in Asia, that governments and political and economic elites were very worried about building new hotels and recovering the land for beaches for the hotels. And this was kind of the strategy to reach economic recovery. But again, this economic recovery was not shared by more local and indigenous communities. What we are finding now in a case study we're conducting now in San Andres is something similar. San Andres is a small island that belongs to Colombia, but sits in the Caribbean. It is also affected by climate change like many other islands in the Caribbean. And what we see when we talk to women in San Andres, in this small island in the middle of the Caribbean, is that they fear that often the what is called sustainable development is actually the development that benefits big corporations, international brands, and big companies. For example, women in San Andres fear the arrival, the increasing arrival of big chains of hotels in the island. Why? Because they prefer another type of tourism. They would prefer to be in charge or in conducting and running these small businesses of small hotels they have been running for years. And those international hotels and brands, of course, are competition for them. And they fear that because what is at stake at the end is that the resources are not a state in the island. What they fear is that these international and multinational corporations take the money out of the island. What they want is jobs. What they want is business opportunities. And what they want is resources that will stay in the island. So yes, this is very important. It's very important that we guarantee that economic recovery benefits the most vulnerable. But we must also remember that we also accept kind of a double standard. When the rich build, we accept the conditions. They're usually approved to build close to the sea, for example, or close to rivers. But when the poor do it, we usually consider that too risky, too dangerous. We kind of play a double standard here. And this eventually leads to the relocation, the evictions, and the displacement of, for example, vulnerable communities or informal settlements. So again, we have to be very careful with the language we use, because sometimes this language of resilience and sustainability eventually leads to secondary effects. For example, not guaranteeing that economic recovery touches the most vulnerable people.
I wanted to ask you if you can give us some examples from your work that illustrate why the what we see as informal actually addresses the real needs of local people, and how outsiders using informal as in a derogatory way is so misguided and maybe stops us from really understanding risk properly in that context.
Right. Yeah, first of all, we must remember that the informal sector is actually the largest industry in the world. It is responsible for about 40% of construction in developing countries. It is responsible for the development of about 40 to 50% of cities in developing countries. It is also often accused of destruction, as I mentioned before. The case of Haiti and many other cases prove it, in which we point to the informal sector and blame the informal sector for the destruction that follows. Vernacular solutions in agriculture, in mining, in commerce, for example, are often accused of being dangerous, of being too risky, and therefore they are usually considered to be replaced by the kind of activities that corporations and established firms and multinationals can put in place. This leads to the fact that the informal sector is often neglected or ignored, both in the development of housing construction and in post-disaster reconstruction. So authorities usually tend to ignore the fact that this informal sector already plays a fundamental role in providing affordable solutions for the poor, the marginalized. When disasters happen, a similar reaction occur. Basically, authorities prefer to transfer contracts to well-established companies and sometimes to international companies. The idea behind that is to centralize decision-making. Sometimes it is connected to the idea of facilitating management by concentrating decisions in one single contract. But sometimes it's also related to corruption, the idea to provide handsome contracts to those in the private sector who can later on support political agendas, for example. And the consequence of this is that small businesses, informal small businesses that are an integral part of the economy and that are an integral part of urban development are often neglected and ignored in the reconstruction process that follows. And the problem with that is that the funding that is invested in reconstruction often goes to these big companies that benefit from and obtain profits from the investment. But the reality is that very few local companies and very few firms in the informal sector actually benefit from the investments that are usually put after disasters. And this is a huge problem because these international companies or big corporations or mighty construction companies move to another context very quickly. And the economic benefits do not stay in the affected area. So we need to create those new mechanisms in which the informal sector's capacities are recognized, and then informal sector and civil society groups are integrated in decision-making process after disasters and are integrated in the development that follows disasters so that the local economy is improved after the investment.
Well, wow, this has really been fascinating. I think there is so much to talk about and there is so much to think about. And hopefully in the further episodes and further seasons of the podcast, we will be unpacking some of the issues that, Gonzalo, you've brought forward for us today. So, yeah, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure. But maybe just to wrap up and to conclude, we must remember that colonialism, neocolonialism, and neoliberalism are not certainly the same thing. But they share something in common, and is this idea of domination. And this idea of domination increasingly is provided through neoliberalism, neoliberal policy, which calls for a reduction of the state, reducing investment in social programs, privatizing services, selling assets that belong to the state, reducing taxes, and so on. And the consequences of this is that they deteriorate the institutions that are required to deal with risk, disasters, and today to deal with climate change. And the consequence of this is that when disaster strikes, local institutions do not have the capacity to respond to the main challenges. So we need to create a different narrative. We need to start working on a different narrative, a narrative in which we reinforce local institutions, but we also reinforce from the bottom up the informal sector, the civil society. So from one side, we need to reinforce those public institutions that can protect citizens and nature. But from the other side also, we need to reinforce informal companies, informal businesses, micro businesses, small companies, and civil society groups so that they can take a decision-making role before and after disasters. If we manage to do this, maybe, and there are enough examples to show us that this can be done. But if we start doing this, maybe we can find better ways of dealing with disasters, reducing the displacement that we're facing today, and hopefully dealing with the challenges posed today by climate change.
Hopefully this podcast can play a part in shifting the narrative in our area of study and for people who are trying to understand, you know, what causes disasters and what the impacts of disasters are. And we look forward to opening up this discussion. So I just wanted to ask you as well, is there any particular work that you've done or are doing that you would direct our listeners to if they want to find out more about you and your work?
Well, I've been working on a book for the last 2 years. Hopefully it's going to be out in January or February. The book is called Unnatural Disasters, Why Most Efforts to Deal with Disasters and Climate Change Fail, and Some Don't. That's the title of the book.
That's brilliant.
And it's about to come out, and hopefully, if everything goes well, in winter next year. Some of these examples I mentioned here, the Gujarat Reconstruction Project, Colombia, Haiti, Central America, Cuba, will be part of the stories in that book. I still need to finish writing. And hopefully the whole thing will be ready for next year.
Great. Really look forward to that.
Well, as always, I guess we'll give links to some of Gonzalo's work on our Podbean website, podcast site. So if you've enjoyed listening to us and if you've enjoyed listening to Gonzalo Lizaralde today, please follow us on Twitter, follow us on Instagram, and, well, you know where to get your podcast.
Thank you very much, Jason. Thank you very much, Ksenia, for this invitation. It was a pleasure to be here. You have been listening to Disaster Deconstructed podcast with me, Gonzalo Lizaralde, Ksenia, and Jason. Thank you very much.